Now, one of the questions that many people have about the world as we know it is, why is there so much suffering in our world? Now, all of us know about suffering. All of us have experienced suffering to some extent or other. But it's true that some of us happen to be healthier than others. Sometimes we might think we have it bad, but often a visit to the children's ward in a hospital is enough to help us see that there are many people out there whose suffering is tremendously great. Like the case of Faith and Hope, the twin daughters born to a Sydney couple recently, and some of you may have heard of this. The girls were born with separate identical faces and separate brains in a single skull and sharing the same body. Now, sadly, they passed away after only 19 days after being born. Another example is the case of Lizzie Velasquez. She was born with an extremely rare unnamed syndrome that prevents her from gaining weight. She's also blind in one eye. She discovered that a YouTube video of herself had gone viral with people making fun of her ugliness. And so she has the nickname, the ugliest woman in the world. 8 years after she discovered the video going viral like that, she has turned those negative comments into an opportunity to inspire others who suffer from severe physical conditions through things like going on television, writing books, and even working as a motivational speaker. How can we explain such suffering? Well, when it comes to dealing with issues, it's important that as Christians that we seek to have the bigger picture in mind when we think about these things. And the ultimate reality for us as Christians, the faith that we confess, is that Jesus is Lord. So we need to try and think about difficult issues like this from the perspective of the Lordship of Christ as revealed to us in the Gospel. And I've been suggesting to you as we've been looking at various issues over the last weeks or so that a useful framework for us to be able to do that is to look at everything through the truths of generation, degeneration, and regeneration. So today we want to look at the issue, how does suffering fit into God's created order? What is its connection with sin? And how can suffering be overcome through what Jesus has done? So to start off with then, we need to ask the question, what was the place of suffering in the Garden of Eden? What do you think? Was there suffering in the Garden of Eden? Most people are shaking their heads. As Christians, we typically see suffering and death as being ultimately part of the same process. And we know that death only entered into this human sphere of things as a result of disobedience to God. In the beginning, God told Adam, "You may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die." Whilesoever Adam kept that command, death would not play any part in human existence. And with death not around, we assume that suffering didn't exist back then either. But does that mean that no such thing as pain existed back then in the Garden of Eden? What about if, say, Adam happened to stub his foot against a rock or drop something heavy on his foot? Would he feel no pain? Or would he be so alert and careful back in the garden there as to never find himself in that kind of situation? Well, I'm not exactly sure what the answers to those questions might be, but perhaps we can take a lead from Psalm 91, verses 11 and 12 in particular. Now, this is a psalm that talks about how God will protect the person who takes refuge in him. The person who takes shelter under God's protecting wings will be protected from every form of evil. That person will be protected from traps, from deadly pestilence, from night terrors, from arrows, destruction, and plague. It says in that psalm that no evil shall be allowed to befall you, for he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up, lest your foot strike against a stone. So perhaps it's the case that maybe, don't know for sure, but perhaps it would have been the angels who would have protected Adam from ever stubbing his toe. Whatever the case, it's true that the concept of pain isn't mentioned in the Bible until Genesis 3:16, which is after the sin of Adam and Eve. It's when God talks about the punishment that Eve will receive for her part in the first sin. And that punishment is that the pains of childbirth will be great. We also get pain mentioned in the next verse when God punishes Adam for his part in the first sin. Adam would only make a living from the ground, now cursed by God in pain. So it seems, therefore, that we have to conclude that no suffering or pain existed back then in the garden. But sin changed all of that, didn't it? Looking at this issue through the lens of degeneration, we can see how Adam's sin against God led to him and Eve being kicked out of the garden. This meant that from that time on, every person born into the human race would be born outside of the garden. And outside of the garden is a world where the active presence of God's Spirit is a little bit limited. Outside of the garden is a zone where the active guardianship of the angels is also a little bit limited and sporadic, rather than being at 100%. This, in addition to the cursing of the ground, which was part of God's punishment against the first sin, would mean that pain and hardship would enter into human existence. And we know that as a result of that, eventually also death. As we read in Genesis 3:19, by the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Death has entered the equation. It doesn't sound good, does it? Instead of living in a garden paradise, free from pain and suffering, now the human race is battered from pillar to post by all sorts of sicknesses and diseases until eventually we die. Now, the Vietnamese have an interesting saying about this, and that saying is actually originally a Chinese one, which captures the problem of human suffering well. And you've got it up on the board for you there. Anyone want to read the Vietnamese? Brendan? You got a bit of Vietnamese in your background, don't you? Anyway, it's very similar to the Chinese. Sing Lao Bang Do. Anyone want to read the Chinese? We've got a few Chinese speakers here. Does that sound like the Vietnamese? Pretty close. But what does it mean? Well, basically it means born, old, sick, dead. These are the four sufferings according to Buddhism. And notice that being born into the world, from their perspective, is actually bad. You don't want to be born into the world. You want to sort of escape it, according to Buddhism. What happens? Well, it's a good summary of what happens in life, isn't it? You're born, then you get old, then get sick, and die. Great summary. It's the cycle of life that, in the end, leads to death. And none of us, in and of ourselves, no matter what the advances of medical technology might be, none of us can escape that cycle. But why does suffering exist? Well, the Bible obviously tells us that human suffering stems from human disobedience to God. But it's one thing to say that, isn't it? It's another thing to try and explain, well, why is it that God has allowed suffering to enter into our world? Now, there are some Christians who speak about suffering and sickness as being solely the work of the devil, as if God had nothing to do with it. It's one of the ways that we can try and explain away suffering, isn't it? It's got a kind of logic to it, that view. It takes God out of the equation. It absolves him of any responsibility when it comes to suffering. But I believe that that's a human logic that isn't really consistent with what the Bible teaches. Now, granted, the devil does have a large part to play in the sorry state in which humanity finds itself. But the Bible teaches us that everything that happens, the good as well as the bad, is all actually part of God's overarching plan. Let's put it this way. When Satan rebelled against God soon after the world was made, couldn't God have destroyed Satan right there and then? Is there something stopping God from destroying Satan whenever God wants to? Couldn't God also have stopped the snake from entering the garden in order to go and tempt Adam and Eve? Surely God knew Satan's whereabouts and what Satan was planning to do. And also think about the fact that God planted a tree called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which he forbade humans to eat from. Did God have to plant that tree? Did he have to keep the fruit of that tree to himself? Even if the fruit had some spectacular and special powers, then why place it unguarded in the middle of the garden with such attractive fruit on it? And God somehow didn't know what might happen next? The Bible tells us that God knows everything from beginning to end. In his plan, everything is predestined. Everything follows his blueprint. So the solution to the theological problem of suffering doesn't lie in limiting God's knowledge or in limiting God's power in some way. Rather, the solution to the issue of suffering lies in understanding that God has a bigger purpose and plan in allowing sin and suffering to enter into his creation. Well then, what is that bigger purpose? Well, to answer this question, we're forced to turn to the truth of regeneration. Now let me ask you, which is better? Generation or regeneration? What do you think? What's better, generation or regeneration? Put it another way, where do we get the total realization of God's positive purposes for the world displayed? Do we get it back at the time of generation, in the beginning, in the creation of the world, or do we get the total realization of God's positive purposes for the world realized through regeneration? Which one? What do you think? Regeneration? Yeah, it's at the time of regeneration. Regeneration is when the totality of God's kingdom will appear. It's when everything in that kingdom will ultimately be perfect and fully complete. So what this means is that regeneration is an integral part of the bigger picture. Regeneration is where creation is heading towards. What I'm saying here is that God has had regeneration in mind from the very beginning. If regeneration is the final centerpiece of God's plan for creation, what does regeneration presuppose? What do you think? What comes before regeneration? In order to have regeneration, you need to have degeneration as well as generation. So regeneration presupposes not just generation, but significantly here, in order to have regeneration, you actually have to have degeneration first. So if regeneration is part of God's plan, don't we have to say that degeneration is also somehow part of God's plan? You can't have regeneration without first having degeneration. We can think about it this way. What do you think displays God's power more? A world in which there was just generation, either fully complete right from the very beginning or developing that kind of completeness over time, or a world in which generation is almost totally wiped out by degeneration only to be rescued through an amazing work of regeneration. Which of those situations actually displays God's power more? We can also think about it this way. Imagine witnessing a baby growing up to live eternally. That would be a pretty special thing to see. But imagine a different situation in which that cute baby grew up only to die a few months or years later. But then, after that, you see that baby which once was dead now coming back to life again to live eternally. Now, out of those two situations, which one is sadder? The first one or the second one? The second one. The situation in which the baby dies, that's sadder, isn't it? But which situation out of those two allows more of God's power to be displayed? It's also the second one. If sin never entered the world, and if we never ever died, then we wouldn't really know the extent of God's love and forgiveness, or the extent of God's power of resurrection. And friends, that's the main reason that suffering and death have been allowed to happen as part of God's overarching purpose for his world. Because without degeneration, there's no such thing as regeneration. And without regeneration, our personal knowledge of God's wisdom and mercy and power is severely restricted. Now, what I'm saying here is backed up by the situation of the man born blind that we see in John chapter 9. One day, as Jesus left the temple in Jerusalem, he saw a man who had been born blind. And his disciples asked Jesus at that time, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents?" What's the explanation for the fact that this man has been born blind? Now, Jesus' disciples knew that suffering is the result of sin. So they were wanting to know who's to blame in the circumstances of that man's life. Was it the man himself or his parents that he was born blind? But notice how Jesus answered them. Did Jesus blame the man for the man's condition? Did Jesus blame the parents for the fact that the man was born blind? Did Jesus blame Satan for the man's condition? Who did Jesus blame? The man, his parents, or Satan? Any of those? No. Jesus doesn't mention any of those. Not the man himself, not the parents, not even Satan. Who then was to blame for the man's condition? Will you tell me from the text? Who's to blame for the man's condition? In effect, God. Have a look in verse 3. Jesus answered, "It's not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him." In other words, according to Jesus' words there, Why was the man born blind? He was born blind in order that the works of God might be revealed through him. In other words, he was born blind because God wanted him to be born that way so that the miracle that Jesus was about to perform on him might lead to people praising God. You can see the man being born that way was also part of God's bigger plan, that through him God's power might be able to be displayed to many people. From Jesus' words here, we learn a couple of important things. First of all, we learn that sickness and suffering aren't necessarily the direct or indirect result of personal sin. Now, it can be that way, but not always. And secondly, we also learn here something about the place of sickness and suffering in the bigger purposes of God. The next time that someone asks you, how is it that a good and powerful and loving God can allow suffering in the world? Well, answer them exactly as Jesus does in John chapter 9, verse 3. It's so that the works of God might be displayed in our world. God allows degeneration in order that his mercy and power of regeneration might be revealed to humanity. And friends, isn't that the story of the cross? Isn't that what's revealed to us through the cross? Why should God, when he entered into the world in human form, go and die on a cross? Was the cross an afterthought, or was it planned from the very beginning, from even before our world was created? If it was planned from the very beginning, then why? Why the cross? Well, isn't John chapter 9, verse 3 also the answer to this question? It's so that the works of God might be made manifest through him. It's only by Jesus dying that we can know and appreciate the power of his resurrection. God has designed everything. Everything in creation. It follows God's plan. Every event of human history. Everything has been designed such that through everything, God has the opportunity to reveal himself, his character and his power in exactly the way that he wants to. Notice how, according to verse 5 there in John 9, that Jesus is the key to the alleviation of human suffering. Jesus said to his disciples, "We must work the works of him who sent me while it's day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." And then he healed the man of his blindness, which led many to praise God for the power of healing that he had shown through Jesus. Friends, Jesus states here that he is the light of the world. According to what he says, night is coming during which no one can work. It's interesting to think about, when is that time of night that Jesus is talking about there? It seems to correspond to the time when Jesus is no longer physically present in the world. Now, I don't think that Jesus' words here are meant to be understood in a black and white manner. I think that miracles of healing can still happen today. But healing and the alleviation of suffering is something that can only really happen on a large scale when Jesus is physically present with us. That is why the day of resurrection won't take place until Jesus returns. According to the Bible, day of resurrection is the day when death and sorrow and pain will be no more. So that means no matter what relief and recovery we may experience from sickness and disease in this life, no matter what miracles might happen in this life, the biggest miracle of all, the resurrection of the dead, is still yet to come. And friends, it's that day that should be uppermost in our minds. Now, God can do wonderful things today, and we might ask him to do that. But friends, the best is yet to come. And our focus should ultimately be on what Jesus is going to do for the world when he returns. So, whenever we come across suffering as Christians, whether it's our own suffering or the suffering of others, what's the ultimate solution? Well, if someone's in pain, pray for them. Take them to the doctor. Make use of the medicines that God has created in our world. Take medical advice, yes. But in the end, what's the ultimate solution to human suffering? The Bible tells us quite clearly the ultimate solution to the problems that we have in the world is Jesus. It's actually in knowing Jesus and the power of his resurrection. It's when we have his resurrection power at work in our bodies that the problem of human suffering and pain will be overcome. So friends, if you want the suffering to stop, there's a lot of suffering in our world. And really, the best thing that we can do is to point people to Jesus.